This episode features adult themes and depictions of violence, including depictions of violence against minors. Listener discretion is advised.
Emergency.
Please help me.
Oh, well, slow down.
We were all shot and hold up.
Okay. Where are you at?
1201 East Amador, Las Cruces Bowl.
Las Cruces Bowl?
Yes.
Las Cruces, New Mexico is a city roughly 45 miles north of the U.S.-Mexico border. Just a short drive away from El Paso, Texas, Las Cruces has a population of around 100,000, making it the second largest city in New Mexico. However, 30 years ago, the population was roughly half that, just a tad over 50,000, and a good chunk of those residents had been drawn to the region because of the nearby school. New Mexico State University is the state's only land-grant university, and the city of Las Cruces has really grown around it. In the mostly rural desert state of New Mexico, it seems to be a bit of an outlier that also doubles as an oasis in a way, as Las Cruces has really sprouted up along the Rio Grande over the years. In Las Cruces is a building that is no longer in use. It is located along East Amador Avenue, what has been a busy shopping and recreation center for some time. For several years, this building was known as the region's most popular bowling alley. Originally named the Las Cruces Bowl, it was usually full of competitors dueling each other in bowling tournaments. That is, when it wasn't full of groups of family and friends that bowled for fun. But on one day, almost 30 years ago, the Las Cruces Bowl was home to one of the most brutal and tragic incidents in American history. This is the story of the Las Cruces Bowling Alley Massacre. Welcome to Unresolved. I am your host, Michael Whelan. Before I get started, I just briefly want to let you know how you can help support the show. If you would like to support Unresolved, please consider heading to patreon.com/unresolvedpod to get access to commercial-free episodes, bonus episodes, and much more. Once again, that's patreon.com/unresolvedpod. If you would like to learn more about the show, just visit our website, which is unresolved.me. Or listen through to the close of the episode for more information. Now, without any further ado, here is today's story. Early on the morning of February 10th, 1990, a Saturday, 34-year-old Stephanie Sinak arrived at the Las Cruces Bowl. Stephanie was the manager of the bowling alley, also happening to be the daughter of the bowling alley's owner, Ronald Sinak. With her on this day in question was her 12-year-old daughter, Melissa Repass, as well as Melissa's 13-year-old friend, Amy Hauser. Melissa and Amy, who were close friends, worked in the bowling alley's daycare section, helping supervise some of the kids in there when they could. Because this was a Saturday, it was a good chance for them to get out of the house and help out, helping watch the kids of employees and some others. It was just 8 o'clock in the morning, and both Melissa and Amy were with Stephanie in the manager's office. There, Stephanie was preparing to open for the day, going through the receipts from the prior night and making sure that everything looked good on the books. 12-year-old Melissa and 13-year-old Amy, meanwhile, were just waiting for the bowling alley to open, going in and out of the manager's office, looking for snacks and trying to occupy their busy minds. Two of the people they crossed paths with in the early morning hours were Steve Sinak and Ida Holgan. Steve Sinak was the brother of Stephanie, the opening manager, as well as the uncle of 12-year-old Melissa Repass. He was not working on this day, but had dropped by earlier that morning to pick up some stuff, and he ended up leaving a short time after 8 a.m. You'll learn more about him later. Ida Holgan, the other person that the two girls encountered, was the 33-year-old snack cook at the bowling alley. She spent the hours before opening preparing their food options for the day, and getting their small little kitchen up to speed for the upcoming lunch rush. It was in this early morning quiet, a short time after 8 a.m., that the relative peace of the Las Cruces Bowl was interrupted and then broken. At around 8:20 a.m., two strange men stormed into the Las Cruces Bowl. Neither of the men were wearing masks or gloves, but they stormed in through the bowling alley's unlocked front door without a care in the world. One of the men was carrying a .22 caliber pistol, which he raised at Ida Holgan, the cook who was currently at work in the bowling alley's kitchen. He demanded the grown woman head towards the manager's office, where his partner was currently corralling the two teenage girls, Melissa and Amy. It wasn't until Ida, Melissa, and Amy were ordered into the manager's office that Stephanie Sinak had any idea there were intruders inside the bowling alley. Now, the two gunmen demanded the four women lie down on the floor. These two men promised to let the women go if their demands were met, but it seemed like their purpose wasn't quite clear yet. They took several moments to get to their point, rummaging through the room as if they were looking for something. After a minute or so of this mayhem, which felt like a lifetime to those involved, the men then began demanding access to the bowling alley's safe, which only Stephanie could open. Stephanie Sinak opened up the safe for the gunmen, allowing them access to thousands of dollars. It was estimated that the men would steal somewhere between $4,000 and $5,000. The total amount isn't quite clear, but most intriguingly, the men left behind some cash. They did not steal all of it, implying to investigators that robbery might not have been their sole motive. After they had gathered up bundles of cash, the men seemed poised to make their getaway. But in the confusion of these few minutes, their robbery was interrupted by someone entering the bowling alley through the unlocked front doors. Steve Tehran was a 26-year-old mechanic at the bowling alley, whose job it was to fix the machines and make sure that the lanes themselves kept operating. Known as a stern but loving young man, Steve was known for upholding a rigorous moral code, always insisting that those around him do the right thing, as his brother later put it. Steve had recently attended a military university and was in the New Mexico National Guard. His loved ones stated that he planned to become a police officer in the near future, and was making steps to better his future, not only for him, but his family. You see, in addition to being married to a woman named Audrey, Steve had two children, his 6-year-old stepdaughter, Paula Holgan, of no relation to Ida, and his 2-year-old daughter, Valerie Tehran. On this Saturday in question, February 10th, 1990, Steve had been unable to arrange childcare for his two daughters. His wife, Audrey, was attending class at the nearby university, so Steve had been put in charge of watching the girls for the day. Unable to arrange a sitter, he had decided to bring them to work with him and drop them off at the daycare. So, just after 8:20 a.m., Steve entered the Las Cruces Bowl with 6-year-old Paula and 2-year-old Valerie in tow. As they walked through the unlocked front doors, they were surprised to see no one in the lobby or the kitchen. So Steve began walking towards the manager's office, where he stumbled upon this evolving crime scene. The two armed men inside the manager's office began grappling with Steve, and within moments, they had overpowered him. He and his daughters were cornered, along with the other victims, and it was just after this that the carnage began. The two gunmen opened fire on the victims, shooting each of the 7 hostages multiple times. Each of the victims were shot in the head, execution style, including the teenage girls, Melissa and Amy, as well as Steve's daughters, Paula and Valerie. Nobody in the room was spared, and the gunmen left the room believing that they had killed each man, woman, and child inside. Before the two gunmen left the bowling alley, however, they had begun gathering some papers on top of the manager's office desk, which they then set on fire. It is believed that they were hoping to destroy any evidence of them having been there, and over the next several minutes, this fire would continue to grow. Now, with all of the victims supposedly subdued and a fire started, the two gunmen took this opportunity to make their escape, absconding with a grand total of $5,000 from the bowling alley safe. At around 8:29 a.m., Las Cruces emergency dispatchers received a 911 call from a phone inside the bowling alley. On the other end of the phone, 12-year-old Melissa Repass told the dispatcher what had just unfolded.
Emergency.
Please help me.
Well, slow down.
We were all shot in a holdup.
Okay. Where are you at?
1201 East Amador, Las Cruces Bowl.
Las Cruces Bowl?
Yes.
Okay, and there were shots fired?
Yes. All of us were hurt.
Huh?
All of us were hurt. I think I'm the only one conscious.
All of you were hurt? Okay, we'll get an ambulance rolling.
Please.
Okay, what's your name?
Melissa Repass. Please hurry.
Okay, Melissa, we've got him dispatched. Did you see who did it?
No, sir. They told us all to get down. They shot me 5 times.
Okay, we'll get him rolling, Melissa. Just hang on. Take a deep breath. That patrol unit's in route. How many people are hurt?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
7 people are hurt?
Yes, I think. I
7 subjects hurt. Okay. Okay, Melissa.
It hurts.
It hurts. Okay. Melissa, I've got an ambulance and I've got the police officers en route. They'll be with you just shortly.
Okay.
Okay. You didn't see what any of the
Mom,
men were
they
wearing?
They took all of our money.
You didn't
I
see what any kind of the men were wearing or anything?
No.
Nothing, huh? They just walked in?
Uh-huh.
Do you know if they were black men, white
with
men?
Mom, black men. They're both black.
2 black men?
Yeah.
Okay. No, they've left. 2 black male.
Please hurry.
Okay, okay. It's okay, Melissa.
There's a fire, too.
There's a fire?
Right on the desk. They're going to burn us up.
Are the men still there?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know. They put us in the office.
They put you in the office?
Yes, I need a fire engine, too. Please help me.
And two. Okay, Melissa. She said they locked them in the office. She doesn't know if they're still there or not.
The door's open. There's a fire.
It's on Amador, yeah.
Please
can you
help.
Smell smoke, Melissa?
Yes, I can see it.
Okay.
Can I get the fire extinguisher?
Fire department, too?
Yes.
She says she smells smoke. They may have lit the building on fire.
No, it is on fire.
It is on fire.
It is.
Okay, Melissa.
Can I go
stand
get the...
Stand by, Utility One.
Oh, ow.
Okay, Melissa, we've got him coming, hon. We've got him coming.
Is somebody... He's calling my mommy.
Okay, Melissa, there's a police officer there now, okay?
There is?
Yes, there is. He's going to try and find you.
We're in the office. Just tell him.
Stand by at 33 traffic.
Oh,
God.
Okay.
I'm
going to
die.
Hold on, Melissa. We've got the ambulance coming. They're just down the street. Huh? She advises all 7 are shot, they're injured, they're in the office. Where's the office at, Melissa?
Girl, in the door, the front desk, and then you take a right, and we're right in the building.
Okay. She says you go in, to the first desk, take a right, and you're right there at the office. Okay, I'm giving the directions on how to get to you, to the police officers that are there.
Oh, my God, please help me.
We're helping you, Melissa. We've got them rolling. Okay? You've got to be brave. Got to be strong now. Okay?
Oh, God. It's going to burn us right now.
Okay. Can you see flames?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's burning us.
Okay.
Oh, I got bullets in my feet.
Okay.
The bullets in my head.
You bullet the bullets in your head, too? Go ahead. I hear the officers telling you to get out. Get out.
I can't. There's nobody else.
Was that the police officer telling
yeah.
you to get out?
Yeah.
Then get out.
Okay.
Okay?
Melissa Repass, the 12-year-old daughter of Las Cruces Bowl manager Stephanie Sinak, had been shot 5 times in total. However, even after witnessing this brutality firsthand and surviving, she thought back to what she had just been taught a few weeks prior, call 911. This quick thinking ended up saving not only Melissa's life, but 2 others, as emergency services were able to arrive to the crime scene in a little over 1 minute. As you just heard from that call, police officers and firefighters were able to arrive at the Las Cruces Bowl in near record time, and went to work on those inside the manager's office. Because of the fire that had been started, first responders radioed in for immediate backup, and then began hauling out all 7 of the bodies inside the manager's office out into the lobby of the bowling alley. Once out there, they were able to begin treating each of the victims, who were, for the most part, bleeding profusely and unconscious. 12-year-old Melissa Repass, her 34-year-old mother Stephanie Sinak, and 33-year-old Ida Holgan were all stabilized and then rushed to Memorial General Hospital in Las Cruces. Valerie Teran, Steve Teran's 2-year-old daughter, went along with them, but would end up passing away in the hospital just later that day. The other 3 victims, 26-year-old Steve Teran his 6-year-old stepdaughter Paula Holgan, and 13-year-old Amy Hauser were all pronounced dead at the scene. Paramedics and EMTs had responded quickly, but unfortunately not quick enough to save them. Firefighters were quickly able to drown out the fire inside the manager's office, but investigators would later worry about the cost of the fire and the later firefighting effort. It was unknown how much evidence had been washed away battling this fire, but that would end up being an issue for another day. In the meantime, police officials began coordinating with a local U.S. Border Patrol and spreading throughout the area, establishing roadblocks and keeping an eye out for local suspects. In her panicked 911 phone call, 12-year-old Melissa Repass had identified the gunmen as black men, but that would change in just a few hours, with police believing the suspects to be Hispanic men with dark complexions, who might be planning to leave the area or the country in the very near future. The events of February 10th, 1990 would continue to shock and terrify the region for months, years, and even decades afterwards. For obvious reasons, it was dubbed the Las Cruces Bowling Alley Massacre by the press in the days after. The massacre, as it was known, had taken 4 victims: Steve Terran, Paula Holgan, Valerie Terran, and Amy Hauser. Amy's parents and other loved ones were now deprived watching the 13-year-old grow old. She had become such a fun-loving and heartwarming presence in all of their lives, and her infectious singing was missed immediately. Meanwhile, Audrey Terran, the widow of Steve and mother to 6-year-old Paula and 2-year-old Valerie, had lost her entire family in one fell swoop. Personally, I can't even imagine the pain and anguish that she must have gone through in the immediate aftermath of this heinous crime. She would understandably refuse to speak to the media for years afterwards. The other victims, Stephanie Sinak, Ida Holgan, and Melissa Repass, would also be facing a number of issues in the short term and the long term. They had each been shot several times, including in the head, and they would be looking at lengthy stays in local hospitals in their road to recovery. While loved ones began making arrangements for funerals and memorial services, the wheels of justice began kicking the Las Cruces Police Department into action, with every local police officer and detective being called in to assist. The fire inside the manager's office at the Las Cruces Bowl had ended up destroying a lot of valuable evidence. Almost all of the interactions between the gunmen and the victims had been inside the manager's office, and the fire had ended up burning a lot of it away. Then, when firefighters arrived, they had inadvertently ended up dispersing or diluting a lot of evidence that remained. It was an understandable decision, of course, but one has to wonder just what was lost in the effort to quell the flames. Detective Mark Myers, who took over the investigation years later, stated about this, quote, "It was a very complicated crime scene. They lit the office on fire. That's a clear indication they were thinking about destroying evidence they had left behind. They weren't going to leave any witnesses, no matter how young. I have no doubt when they left, they thought everyone in there was dead." In the time since the massacre happened, police officials have confirmed that forensic evidence was found inside the manager's office. They have also stated that this evidence has been submitted to state databases for analysis and further testing, but when pressed about specifics, have refused to reveal what exactly they found. The closest thing I could find is Detective Mark Myers stating, quote, "We did recover fingerprints, but it was a bowling alley. You would expect to find that." So it seems clear that with this investigation kicking off in 1990, well before DNA revolutionized crime solving, police began taking a more personal angle to this case. They canvassed people in the surrounding area and began looking for anyone that might have seen or heard anything. They were able to find a couple of witnesses at the very least. There was one who claimed to have heard the shots happening from a nearby business, where he or she had been working on the morning of the massacre. A second witness, who also worked nearby, claimed to have seen 2 men running away from the scene at around the same time that Melissa Repass was making her 911 call. Their witness accounts would be added to one other's, a man close to the crime scene who had left the bowling alley just before the crime unfolded. That third witness was Steve Sinak, who had been at the bowling alley shortly before the 2 gunmen entered. On the morning of the attack, Steve had stopped by the bowling alley to pick up some stuff he had left behind the night prior, and had left just before the 2 gunmen entered the bowling alley. Steve claims that he had seen 2 Hispanic men walking in the region of the bowling alley, perhaps even headed to the entrance. He claims that one of these men was carrying a briefcase, which he handed to the other as they walked. Steve did not piece together these dots until after he learned about the crime, but stated that the two men he had seen had very distinct features. One was older and one was younger. Steve's description would end up forming the basis of the upcoming police sketches. Suspect number one was a young Hispanic male, between 28 and 34 years old, who stood around 5'10", weighed between 160 and 170 pounds, had wavy brown hair and brown eyes, with a mustache and no detectable accent. Suspect number two was an older Hispanic male, who seemed to be between 48 and 54 years old, who stood around 5'6", weighed around 140 pounds, had thinning salt and pepper hair with brown eyes, and who spoke English with a slight Spanish accent. Both of these men were depicted in sketches, which were dispersed to the media in the weeks after this crime. Based on additional witness sightings, it was believed that these two men had fled from the scene in a green four-wheel drive vehicle, perhaps a van. In the hours after the reporting of the massacre in the bowling alley, Steve Sinak gave his description of these two men to police. A short time later, he was called out to a police roadblock, where a single vehicle on the outskirts of town had been pulled over. Inside the vehicle were four Hispanic men, who had thousands of dollars in cash on their person. Steve could not identify any of the men as being the ones he had seen earlier, and this group of men was allowed to leave. Soon enough, the descriptions of these two men were verified by shooting survivor Ida Holgan, who had survived multiple gunshots. She had been present at the bowling alley for this massacre, and was able to provide additional details about the two gunmen. She believed that she had seen these two men at the bowling alley sometime prior to the shooting, in the days, weeks, or months before the horrific crime took place. She and other employees believed that the men might have been casing the joint, and had been there to get a feel for the bowling alley, its layout, schedule, and regular staff hours. Ida and others believed that the gunmen had not gone to the bowling alley to simply rob the place. She would later state that the two gunmen, quote, were looking for something else before they went to the safe. Statements from Ida and the other survivors have hinted at this being perhaps something more than a simple robbery gone wrong. Because of the circumstances of this brutal crime, investigators were left puzzled. I've already detailed the event itself, how the two gunmen entered the bowling alley, held seven people captive, and eventually made the decision to shoot all seven victims. They had left with somewhere between $4,000 and $5,000, but had, for some reason, decided to leave money in the bowling alley's safe. Because of this, investigators were unable to determine if this was a planned robbery or a robbery gone wrong. It became theorized by some that violence might have been the gunman's motive, as they had left behind an undisclosed amount of cash in the bowling alley's safe. They would not have done so intentionally if this was a simple robbery, investigators believe. It remained possible that the two men had planned to rob the bowling alley, and then became overwhelmed once they were actually inside. Perhaps they had not planned for there to be so many people present, and had lashed out violently as a result. Nonetheless, the case began to pivot away from being focused entirely on the robbery motive. That was when investigators began to narrow in on some specific rumors, which alleged that the setting of the crime, the Las Cruces Bowl, was somehow connected to organized crime, either directly or indirectly. Shortly after the shooting took place, rumors began swirling that the owner of the establishment, Ronald Sinak, had some kind of shady business ties, perhaps even being linked to the Mexican cartels, who were undoubtedly active in the region. Because the gunman had mercilessly shot at all of the people in the bowling alley, including Ronald Sinak's daughter and granddaughter, this led police to believe that there might be some truth to these rumors. So they began looking into Ronald Sinak, his family members, and other associates that were linked to them. Investigators were looking for any sign of impropriety, which could illuminate detectives with a possible explanation. Unfortunately, it seems like all of the attempts to investigate Ronald Sinak led to dead ends, as explained by Detective Mark Myers of the Las Cruces Police Department. Quote, "We investigated all of those angles at the time. Thousands and thousands of man-hours went into trying to prove those theories, but we couldn't prove anything. We put Ronald Sinak under a microscope, and we couldn't find anything. To date, all we know for sure is it was a robbery homicide." In the months after the massacre, investigators began to focus in on R.J. Sinak, the younger son of the bowling alley's owner, Ronald Sinak. RJ tended bar at the bowling alley, and several tips had been received by police, claiming that RJ was involved in some kind of drug activity. Police looked into this, and discovered that other than RJ seeming to have a cocaine addiction, there was nothing definitive linking him to this case. He was cleared of wrongdoing, and eventually died of an alleged drug overdose in May of 1997 at the age of 36. Another lead came via a local woman named Irma Tiarina, whose name I hope I am pronouncing correctly. Shortly after the shooting inside the Las Cruces Bowl, she made contact with police and claimed to have encountered two men that matched the descriptions of the shooters. According to Tiarina, she claimed that the two men had stayed with her at around the same time that the massacre happened, and she provided police with details of these men. She would even undergo a polygraph, which meant a lot to investigators at the time. Polygraphs are notoriously unreliable, but in the age before DNA testing became commonplace, polygraph tests carried a lot of weight with police departments. Shortly after taking this polygraph and providing police with details of the two men that had stayed with her, Irma Tiarina recanted her claims. Police had made note of her frequent drug use, and sometime later would stop speaking with her entirely. Like RJ Sinak, Irma Tiarina would pass away at an early age from drug use. She died in May of 2001 from an accidental overdose, taking whatever possible secrets she had with her to the grave. Over the next several months, the investigation continued into the crime dubbed the Las Cruces Bowling Alley Massacre. However, as the days continued to bleed into one another, it became apparent that investigators were no closer to solving the case than they had been on the day of. Perhaps it was just a robbery gone wrong, a heinous crime committed by two men with no remorse. Perhaps there was some explanation to them leaving behind money in the safe, and escaping with only a fraction of the overall possible take. Perhaps there were no easy answers, and this case was destined to be unsolved forever. One of the prevailing theories that emerged in the years afterwards is that a gang of sorts had decided to exact some revenge against specific people in the bowling alley. Perhaps family or friends of the owner, Ronald Sinak. Perhaps a business deal had fallen apart, or a drug deal had gone south, and the victims from the Las Cruces Bowl were simply collateral damage. It was alleged by some that the two gunmen were involved with a regional gang, perhaps even hitmen that had been brought in from Mexico. With the border so close, this remained a likely possibility even years after the fact. As admitted by police officials close to the investigation, because of the brutality of the crime, it seemed like the shooter of all seven hostages might have been meant to send a message. But again, this was all based on guesswork. Investigators had very little to work with, based on the patchy testimony of witnesses and the forensic evidence, which itself seemed to be mostly speculative. There was no clear evidence pointing to a single suspect, and that would not change in the ensuing years. The case of the Las Cruces Bowling Alley Massacre was featured on Unsolved Mysteries with Robert Stack shortly after it happened, in April of 1990. Funnily enough, that episode aired on the day I was born, highlighting just how long ago this happened, and how long the loved ones have been eagerly awaiting answers. The story would be featured on America's Most Wanted on multiple occasions over the next couple of decades, as well as being highlighted in some local news coverage. But other than the occasional mention, usually on the anniversaries, the story began to fade into the background of current events, and the families had to settle with there being no answers for their questions, and no justice for their lost loved ones. Stephanie Sinak, the opening manager of the bowling alley on the morning of February 10th, 1990, and one of just three survivors, had been seriously wounded in the ordeal. Having been shot multiple times, including in the head, Stephanie would suffer through several long-term health complications. For the next 9 or so years, Stephanie Sinak remained frightened, choosing to barely ever leave home. When she did, she showed signs of post-traumatic stress disorder, waging a silent battle against stress and fear. Her loved ones recall her once carefree, fun-loving attitude being permanently changed after this incident, with her having instant reactions to anything that sounded like gunshots, whether they be fireworks, cars backfiring, etc. Stephanie Sinak would pass away in 1999 due to complications from her shooting-related injuries. She was survived by her family, including her daughter, Melissa Repass, who had made the panicked 911 phone call close to a decade beforehand. Melissa Repass and Ida Holgan remained the sole survivors of the shooting, a cross they continue to bear. Even though close to three decades have passed, they remain traumatized by the shooting, and also remain hopeful that justice can be found for those whose lives were lost and affected by this brutal incident. In 2010, a documentary was released about the Las Cruces Bowling Alley Massacre, titled A Nightmare in Las Cruces. The film was directed by Charlie Min, who had learned about the case back in 1990. He had been a college student living on the other side of the country, who was watching Unsolved Mysteries and learned about the traumatic event from afar. It continued to stick with him years after the fact, and he remained emotionally interested. Shortly after the 20th anniversary of the crime, the documentary was released, and it seemed to spark a new wave of interest in the Las Cruces Bowling Alley Massacre. Figures related to the case began to speak openly for the first time in years, including Audrey Theron, the widow of shooting victim Steve Theron, as well as the mother of Paula and Valerie, the two youngest victims. Audrey had to bury her entire family in the wake of the incident, and remained affected by the events from 20 years prior. Quote, "You wait and wait and wait. The first few years, maybe the first 12 years, there was always a lot of anxiety. I was always very antsy and wanting to know more. But after that, I had to put it aside and deal with my anxiety. We've gotten to a point where we just don't get any answers." Audrey wanted the rest of the world to remember just how violent this incident was. Quote, "My two-year-old, she was shot in the forehead, but she wasn't killed immediately. Her spinal cord was severed, though. Had she lived, she would have been a quadriplegic. Maybe people in the Southwest didn't know just how horrible it was, how my daughters were mistreated. It's been 20 years, and people will still stop me and tell me they are praying for me, praying that there will be closure." Speaking to the press in 2016, 26 years after the shooting, Anthony Theron spoke to the Las Cruces Sun, a local newspaper. Anthony, the brother of Steve, had long been an advocate for the victims of the massacre, and remained troubled that police were no closer to solving the case than they had been in 1990. Quote, "In this day and age, things like this don't go unsolved. How did we not get these guys? That's the question I ask myself every day. Numerous people saw these gunmen, so someone out there knows something, and they need to come forward." The building that was once known as the Las Cruces Bowl continues to stand in the same spot it did then. It has changed ownership more than once in the interim three decades, and gone through two different iterations, having been named the Sun Lanes and then the Ten Pin Alley. In June of 2018, the bowling alley was permanently shuttered, bringing an end to the establishment that had once housed so many smiles, and then so much suffering. The case known as the Las Cruces Bowling Alley Massacre remains an active investigation with the Las Cruces Police Department. Its case file, NO4840, remains open and active, with investigators insisting that the case is always being worked on, meaning it hasn't become a cold case. Lieutenant Casey Mullins, who supervises all of the detectives with the LCPD, says that investigators were able to recover evidence from the scene, including forensic evidence, but insist, quote, "A lot of this case is dependent on someone coming forward with information. We are really counting on the public." Despite police having no active lines of inquiry, Lieutenant Mullins remains hopeful that the case will be solved in the near future, hopefully before the 30-year anniversary comes around next February. Quote, "It's extremely frustrating because it's a horror story. Four innocent people lost their lives that day. It's what we're supposed to do, put the bad guys in jail. When we don't do that, it's like we're not doing our jobs. This is still an open first-degree murder case, and the statute of limitations will never run out on these murders." A $25,000 reward exists for any information that can help identify the men responsible for this crime. If you have any information, you could find the necessary resources online or call Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-8477. Or you could even call them locally at 575-526-8000. You can also text your information to CRIMES 274-637. and your identity will remain anonymous. Any other information or inquiries can be sent directly to the Las Cruces Police Department at 575-528-4222. The men responsible for this crime continue to elude investigators, but Audrey Teran, the widow and mother of three of the victims, envisions them living in a lot of fear. Quote, "I picture them hurting and hiding. It can't be too easy. Everyone is looking for you while you're trying to make a normal life for yourself. I picture them in a lot of misery. One can only hope that these sick, selfish bastards find themselves behind bars in the very near future. Until that comes to pass, fingers crossed it happens soon. But until it does, the stories of Stephanie Sinak, Melissa Repass, Amy Hauser, Ida Holgen, Steve Teran, Valerie Teran, and Paula Holgen remain unresolved." Thank you for listening to this episode of Unresolved. If any of you would like to stay in touch with the podcast, make sure to look us up on social media. I'm not super active on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, but I try to make an honest effort. Just search for Unresolved or Unresolved Pod, and our accounts should pop up for you. You can send in any emails to michael@unresolved.me. That's M-I-C-H-E-A-L at unresolved.me. And you could send in any voicemails or text to 831-200-3550. If you want to find a transcript of this episode, or any applicable links or sources, just head to the podcast website, which is unresolved.me. There, you could also find a link to the podcast store, as well as to our Patreon page, which can also be found at patreon.com/unresolvedpod. I hope to have another episode out next week, but that'll depend on a handful of factors. I'm going to be taking a few days off from the podcast to visit with some friends of mine, but I'm hoping to have at least a short episode finished for you by then. There'll definitely be something out, just hopefully it won't be a super short episode. Until then, everyone, stay safe, and I will talk to you later.